Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know anything except how much I hated. But I didn't take anything. I didn't, Jen. Won't you believe it?
Baby, I don't care.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Podshots. I am your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 1947 classic, Out of the Past, written by Daniel Mainwaring, I think, under his pseudonym Jeffrey Holmes. The film was based upon Build My Gallows High, also by Mainwaring, and had an uncredited writing assist from Frank Fenton and James M. Cain, who people may know from this show that we've discussed, Double Indemnity with Zach, and Mildred Pierce with one of the sidebar fellows. The film was directed by Jacques Tourneau and stars Robert Mitchum, Jane Greer, and Kirk Douglas. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest, Mr. Zach Crucy.
Howdy.
Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. Mr. Crucy, what are you having drink-wise for me this evening?
I have a time-honored classic in the Crucy house. It is a Bell's Two-Hearted Ale.
Oh. Well, all right. Mm-hmm. I'm going with something new for you today.
Do it.
It is out of a growler, which I'm not going to drink all of, I promise. But it is called it's from a restaurant that it's famous here in Lincoln, Nebraska. It is Misty's is the steakhouse, and it is Modern Monk's Forbidden Ales is the brand that they're going by, and it is a Kolsch style beer, so a port swing beer.
Mm-hmm.
And it is their description here is the modern monks, three holy men of the craft brewing art, have taken a vow of perfection so you can know undeniable pleasure because that's how cool they are. Now partake in this brew of the highest order and join the brotherhood. So that's a little on the pretentious side when it comes to a Kolsch beer, I feel like, but it's pretty good. And it was relatively cheap for this big old growler here, so that's what I'm enjoying.
Ooh la la.
Ooh la la is right. So, speaking of ooh la la, let's begin our discussion on the 1947 classic Out of the Past.
Yes, let's do it.
It was a nice little joint with bamboo furniture and Mexican gym cracks. One little lamp burned. It was all right, and the rain hammering like that on the window made it good to be in there.
Here.
Hey, not so hard.
Now yours.
No, Jeff, please, it's all right.
Oh, come
Jeff,
on.
Oh, no, not so hard. Jeff, you're my
hair. Hush. Try to dry your hair.
And the plot synopsis for the film over at those fine fellows at IMDb is as follows. For the last 3 years, Jeff Bailey has been laying low and trying to live a normal life. He's been running his own gas station, but prior to that, had been a pretty good private detective. His last job had been for a gangster, Whit Sterling, who hired him to find Kathy Moffat, who just happens to have shot him, and recovered the $40,000 she stole. Jeff found her in Mexico, but fell in love with her. She eventually ran out on him, and he decided it might be better if he found a new line of work. When one of Sterling's henchmen happens to see him pumping gas, he's summoned to the gangster's Lake Tahoe estate. Sterling's offer is quite simple. Recover some incriminating tax files and all will be forgotten. Jeff soon realizes, however, that he's being set up and framed for murder. So this is a film that was a first watch for me. It was a movie that it was a I always knew of it, that it was a classic of the genre, and you know, when you had suggested that we watch it, it wasn't a big surprise that you would have picked it.
Right. Yeah.
But what is it? What is it that you have in terms of history for this film?
My history with it is relatively short, I guess, compared to some of the other ones we've talked about together.
Yeah.
I came to it sort of ass backwards. I came to it through Tournier and Cat People, not as a noir film, although I knew I was aware of it as a noir film, but I didn't actively seek it out for whatever reason.
Now didn't you talk about Cat People on the quad at one point?
Like, yeah.
That's a crazy fucked up movie, right?
Yeah, it's a bizarre, wonderful movie. But anyway, yeah. So I came to it because of Jacques Tournier, who, like I said, directed Cat People, and just kind of immediately fell in love with it. It used to be that, well, it still is that Double Indemnity is my favorite film noir, out of all of the ones that I've seen. But Out of the Past is a real contender for, you know, unseating it. It's like neck and neck, like the whole way. So I really like this movie a lot, and it's one of, if not now, my favorite film noir.
Well, it's interesting because it's kind of like two different styles of the same subgenre, you know, because in Double Indemnity has the voiceover and the he's dead and you know, that sort of thing. Well, I guess that's not necessarily true, because this has the same sort of thing where it's set and then it flashes back to the you know, the past, and then you have the present at the end again. So I guess that they're more similar than I thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, Double Indemnity really invents the genre.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, all of the sort of tricks, if we can use that word, I mean, all of the tricks really start with Double Indemnity and the choices that John Sykes and oh God, this is terrible. Who directed it? Billy Wilder.
Billy Wilder.
Yes, it's all the tricks that Sykes and Wilder, you know, sort of created that make this movie. Or that created the genre and made a movie like this really possible. So
sure. Okay, so getting into the notes here that I have written down, I did manage to get this. I watched this twice, which was nice. You know, I think a lot of the times I fall into the habit of watching a film for the first time and getting a little too hung up on the plot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's going to happen next? You know, that sort of thing. And then when you watch it the second time and you're not really worried about that so much, you're just looking more at like performance and shot choice and that sort of thing a little bit more, like you're digging a little deeper into it. And so I was glad that I had that opportunity here. But one of the things that I really was struck by at the beginning was I like how that Jeff's new relationship, that this relationship that he's, you know, that he forsakes to go to Lake Tahoe. What's her name? It's
Anne,
right?
Anne. Yeah,
I like that. That isn't a real lurid thing. Like it's not like they're sneaking off to go have sex or to go make out or whatever they would be doing in this era. I'm glad that it's kind of like beyond that. You know, to where there is, you know, there is the dangerous woman, you know, by played by Jane Greer as Kathy. But I think that this relationship is, you know, just beyond that sort of purely physical point. And I thought that was kind of nice, to where when you're first introduced to what they may or may not be doing at the lake, it's like, oh, well, they're sneaking off and they're wanting this to be a secret, but everyone knows it and they're probably having sex, and you go there and they're just kind of enjoying each other's company.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, that's nice. Like they're just gonna, oh, well, good for them. Look at that. They're just holding hands or whatever. I don't know if I was a little taken aback by that, but it was enough to get me to write it down. And I do like that she's asking questions and continuing to try to probe his personality a little bit. And she says, you know, she asks if he's been married before, and he says, not that I can remember. And then he kind of gives like a little sly look to the side, which I thought was good. And I thought that overall there was a lot of really, really solid acting with the eyes of all of the actors, which is not something that I usually notice. But here I was like, wow, look, you know, they're just giving like little looks and little glances and doing something different with their eyes compared to now, where it's, you see all of the, you know, like the movie lights reflected in their eyes, and it's like they're staring right at everything that they're, you know, everything's really surface, I feel like.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the, I didn't have that precise note about the eyes, but I think that's sort of the tone of the film is subtlety, right?
Mm-hmm, sure.
I mean, and I guess I want to talk about that in a minute too, but I, just digging back to that, your comments about the relationship with Anne. I mean, I think that that's, I think that that's I thought that's really refreshing, or was really refreshing as well. But I think it's that, it's the relationship that Jeff, Robert Mitchum's character, has to have at that point in his life, right? I mean, that's the thing that keeps him alive and keeps him doing what he's doing. It's that sort of moral center, that sort of pure, you know, ideal that he can try to achieve, but never really gets to, you know?
Sure.
So, I mean, unlike while he's chasing down Kathy, you know, Jane Greer, you know, there's nothing. I mean, that relationship is the exact opposite, right?
Oh, sure.
And they're even physical opposites. I mean, Anne is, very girl next door. You know, she's attractive, but she's very girl next door, and she's blonde. Mm-hmm. And Kathy is not the girl next door. She's ravishing and is this brunette who's got, clearly has a wild side and likes to drink and, you know, cavort around even when she's on her best behavior. You know, she's kind of a party girl.
Yeah.
And where Anne doesn't give that vibe at all.
Well, yeah,
she's very down to earth.
Kathy's sexy and she knows she's sexy.
Right. That's exactly it.
To where Anne's like, oh, I'm attractive. Oh, okay. Thanks.
Yeah, there's a humbleness about her, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's, you know, I thought that was really good. What is it that you were wanting to say about the eyes and that sort of thing? Was it
it's just the subtlety. I mean, this is the reason. And I'm glad you brought it up, because this is the reason that it is up there. You know, to me, is up there against Double Indemnity as my favorite film noir. It's because of the dialogue.
Dialogue
is so crisp and subtle, whereas, you know, and I think that this is, in Double Indemnity, I think it's the heavy hand of Billy Wilder coming in and, you know, making things comical. And I think the more straightforward bits are very much Raymond Chandler, and I think those are some of the best lines, like the I wonder if you wonder, that sort of thing. I mean, they're snappy, they're crisp, they're sarcastic, but the humor in it, I think, is really Wilder's doing. But anyway, you know, where Double Indemnity is very obvious and in your face with that kind of language, Out of the Past is, you know, almost 180 degrees from that, at least in presentation. I mean, that sort of crisp, subtle, sarcastic dialogue is in there, but it just flies right by you. And that scene that you were talking about where they're fishing, where Jeff and Anne, they're fishing and they're getting ready to go back. There's a line there. She says, because the kid, the dumb kid,
the deaf and dumb kid.
Yeah. He comes down and, you know, signals to Jeff that he has to come back. And Jeff says he's got to go. And she says, you're a very, very secretive man, as he's putting a cigarette in his mouth and she's lighting it. Mm-hmm. And he says, and without skipping a beat, he says, thanks. Right?
Yeah.
The visual context is that he's thanking her for lighting a cigarette. But what he just said was he thanked her for acknowledging, like, how secretive and, like, how good he is at just, like, keeping his secrets secret.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's Jeff's whole MO, you know, in those three absent years in the film where he is just the gas station attendant or the gas station owner. And then after that, he follows it up, you know, he redirects it and says, you know, a man just likes to, you know, have his privacy or something like that. But, I mean, but the line is clearly, you're secretive, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And the only thing that sets it off is just sort of the visual with the lighting of the cigarette. So, I mean, it's little things like that that sort of just run throughout the whole movie. And there's another scene, towards the end of the film where, Kathy and Jeff, they are sitting together in that, in San Francisco, just as sort of the fix is in to try to pin, one of the, at least the first murder on Jeff. And she says to him, what does she say? I wrote it down. Oh, she says, you ought to have killed me for what I've done to you. And then he says, well, there's time. And then without missing a beat, she just keeps going, right? I mean, like all the lines just, all those lines like that just fly right under the radar. Whereas, you know, in a film like Double Indemnity, I mean, they're very punchy and very loud. Like, you know, you won't miss those lines. Whereas in this film, you will miss those lines if you're not really paying close attention to what's going on because it's so smooth and just right in there.
Yeah, one of the things along those lines there was the diner sequence at the beginning where we have our waitress. And she's in there talking and, you know, just making kind of like snappy, fast waitress sort of talk. And they ask if something's the matter. They ask her.
Yeah.
And she says, maybe not. And I think that that's such an interesting choice to say maybe not as opposed to maybe. Because it's like a representation of like her mindset. So, well, yeah. maybe something's not the matter as opposed to, well, maybe something is wrong.
Right, yeah. The assumption is that there is a problem.
Yeah. And yeah. I just really like that. It's just like such a tiny little thing. And I was like, oh, I really think that that's clever.
Yeah.
You know?
That's exactly it. That's exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, it's just all those little moments through the whole thing. Like, there's something wrong. Something's going on here. Something's bad. And, like, it, you get that from just those little moments, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's secrets. There is a problem. Everything is not as it seems, you know?
Yeah. So I really enjoy that. And then we start learning more about his history. We go into the past and we see him trying to track down Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
And my first note about that is their dialogue is a lot, well, it's a lot more surface, but it is and it isn't, I guess. But I put their dialogue is fucking hot. Like I really liked the way that those two spoke.
Yeah.
And it was a little bit more on the, you know, femme fatale speaking to the leading man kind of a thing. But it still worked really well. And I'm watching it going, this is just really, really well done dialogue that I don't feel like all the actors that are in today's films would be able to pull off like this.
I mean, maybe some, but I don't think that it would be the standard.
Sure.
Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
It wouldn't be as widespread. Yeah. But that was something that I really kind of appreciated. And, you know, I just think that that's, I don't know, a real quality to the film to where it can be really subtle at times and it can be very overt, like, okay, this is supposed to be sexy. You're supposed to be able to feel the chemistry that these two have on screen. And it's in the screenplay here or in the novel, presumably too. One of the lines that I liked from him was from this back and forth was she says, do you believe me? And he says, baby, I don't care. And yeah. I was like, oh yes, I like that. I was like, I have been there, Jeff.
Yeah. No, that was one of the ones I wrote down as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I mean, the thing to me is about this, especially about scenes like that. I mean, even though Mitchum comes off as very slick and very cool and just, you know, the guy that you want, you know, the sort of male fantasy of what you want to be in that moment. But like what's carrying all of these scenes or who's carrying all of these scenes is Jane Greer.
Yes.
I mean, she is phenomenal in this movie.
Yes, she is.
Like, really incredible. I mean, not only is she, I mean, she's gorgeous, but like, just like, I think I mean, it seems like Robert Mitchum and Kirk Douglas are spending so much time, like, chewing up scenery and trying to be a presence that, like, they're so focused on outdoing one another that she just steps right in and says, fuck you guys, I'm doing this. And, like, she steals the show. I mean, she is the centerpiece, not just to Jeff's life and to Witt's life, Douglas's character, but, I mean, she is the person that's carrying all of these scenes.
Yeah, it's almost like Jane Greer is the film compared to the other noirs being Mitchum and Douglas, to where she's a little bit more subtle than they are.
Yeah.
It's like the repeat viewings, you're like, oh, she's really good. Like, these two are more obvious in what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, and you got, I mean, just even in her character, too, I mean, she's got to change, like, emotions and, you know, like, her look and her demeanor. And all of those changes are really subtle, but, like, you know them. Like, you don't see them happening, but you know them once they've happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think a really good example of that is the scene in the cabin when they're back in the U.S. after being on the run.
In Mexico, yeah.
Yeah, so they're back in the U.S. and they've been together for a little while, and they're on the lam and running away from Kirk Douglas, and then Jeff's old partner catches up with them because he's been sent out to find him. And there's that tussle.
There's a great fight. Yeah, I love that fight.
Yeah, the fight scene is amazing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the best part of that scene is not the punching, right? The best part of that scene is when you watch Jane Greer, when you watch Kathy, and her, like, as like, she, at first she looks startled, and then, like, all of a sudden, like, you just see, like, her eyes lower.
Yes.
And, like, and it's over. It's all over. And, you know, and then she shoots Joe. One of the two Joes in the movie. She shoots Joe, and then that's it. Like, and, you know, she takes off, and the jig is up, not just for her and for Jeff, but just, like, for the movie, right? Like, she's not the damsel in distress that she sort of kind of seemed to be up until that point.
Yeah, because, you know, what I thought was interesting was she comes off as being dangerous in words when you hear Witt talk about, oh, you know, she shot me, stole my 40,000.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, okay, well, she's dangerous. And she comes in and she clearly looks like your traditional femme fatale. And, you know, she's got her, like, skin tight dress on and all that and her big hat. And you're like, holy cow. And they run off, and they, when it's a physical altercation, you're like, oh, okay, well, she's just going to kind of hang back, and Mitchum and Joe are going to, you know, go mano a mano here. And she steps in and shoots him, and that genuinely startled me when that happened, because it was a clear indication of she's not, there's a big difference between knowing someone that is dangerous and actually seeing them act in a dangerous way. Mm-hmm. And it was like, whoa, like, she's not screwing around. Like, she, you know, who knows what she's going to do. And I was, you know, completely suckered when, you know, she keeps flip-flopping back and forth. You know, it seems like she's in love with Jeff at this point. She kills his old partner. She, you know, then ends up, you know, running back to Witt. And you're like, well, what the hell? It's like, what is she doing? Like, you know, I'm on Jeff's side. Like, what the hell? I can't figure this girl out. Like, what is her deal here?
Yeah.
Which I thought was, you know, I put later on after the death of, I think it's Keels. Is that his name? Or Eels?
Eels.
Yeah. After his death, I was like, after this point, I feel like I'm a step behind everything. Like, I feel like I'm losing my thread of what's exactly happening a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's exciting in a film where it's got a lot of twists and turns, but you can kind of, you see them happen and you can appreciate, oh, okay, well, they're doing this. And then towards the end of the film, they start flipping a little bit more, things start happening that you're not quite prepared for at that point even. And, you know, so it just really kept me on my toes, I guess, is what I'm coming down to. And I was really appreciative of that, I guess.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think that's the charm of the movie, right? I mean, a lot of times, you know, you watch enough of these film noirs and you're like, okay, here we go. Here's the femme fatale. Here's the trouble they get into. Okay, here's the twist with the gangster, or here's, you know, where somebody accidentally gets shot, or, you know, I mean, it's not like reading, like, It's not like watching like a Western or something like that, like some, you know, schlocky Western where it's black hats and white hats and you figure it all out right away. I mean, noirs as a genre is by definition more complex, but, sure. But certainly, I mean, it has its tropes, you know, and while Out of the Past has some of those tropes, it takes a lot of them and turns them on their head. I mean, take the notion of like the damsel in distress. I mean, really, Mitchum's character isn't quite a damsel in distress, but he's much more a damsel in distress than any other woman in the film. Mm. I mean, he's the one who needs to be rescued.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it doesn't work out for him, but, you know, he's the one who needs to be rescued. He's the one whose plans go awry. He's the one who's the victim the whole time.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, he never kills anybody. He never harms anybody except for beating a couple of guys up. And the only crimes he commits are petty ones that are designed just to clear his name so he doesn't take the rap for multiple murder charges.
Right, yeah.
I mean, he's the one who needs help. He's the victim the whole time. He's not an agitator. He's not like the typical private detective. I mean, he's not Sam Spade looking for trouble. You know, he's not Fred McMurray's character, you know, like out carousing around trying to, you know, commit insurance fraud. He's not, you know, Walter Neff. He's not William Holden in Sunset Boulevard, where he is deliberately doing wrong things and acting like a sugar daddy and screwing over his friends, right? Mm-hmm. Or not acting like a sugar daddy, you know, leeching off of his sugar mama. So, you know, I mean, he sort of upsets like all of these, you know, noir tropes. I mean, he inverts a lot of them. Where Greer, and so does Jane Greer's character. I mean, Kathy inverts a lot of these tropes too, because she's the dominant force in the film, right? She's not just she's a manipulator, like so many femme fatales, but she's not just a manipulator. I mean, she's an aggressive force for violence and, you know, has literal blood on her hands, not just blood on her. I mean, not to always relate it back to Double Indemnity, but just that's a simple example since we've both seen it and can relate to it. I mean, Barbara Stanwyck's character, I mean, she supposedly has blood on her hands from the killing the first Mrs. Dietrichson, but we never actually see her harm or kill anybody until she shoots Fred McMurray, until she shoots Walter at the end of the movie, right?
Right, yeah.
I mean, the whole rest of the time, she's just sort of a puppet master, you know? Whereas Kathy is both is a puppet master, and she's pulling the strings and getting Wit and Joe and Jeff to do all these different, you know, nefarious things, but she's also not afraid to cap a motherfucker if she feels like it.
That's what I thought was interesting, was that usually that's the big reveal, or that's the big twist or whatever, where it's, you know, the woman is more dangerous than we thought.
Right.
But at the beginning, you're made pretty clear after she shoots Joe that, you know, she's a dangerous woman, like we said. And yeah. Then as she keeps on proving how dangerous she is and how manipulative she can be, I kept finding myself being surprised, because I'm like, my expectations were that, you know, her hand has already been shown. Now she's going to go back to being the damsel in distress, she never does that.
Right. Well, she never does it, but the people around her think that she has.
Yeah, right. She's able. That's what's crazy, is she's able to continue to manipulate and say, "Oh no, 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 I'm not actually a scary person. I just need help. You know, you need to help me out." Like the, you know, "Do you believe me, baby? I don't care." Sort of line of thought.
Mm-hmm.
To where, you know, I guess I wouldn't care who it was. If I saw someone shoot somebody, I'd probably think that they were capable of many things. But that's just me. I wasn't born in the 40s.
I feel like if you see someone and that person is capable of murder, that your view of them sort of radically changes.
I would imagine so. I would hope so.
I don't think that that's like decade or like generation specific. I think that's just across the board. But
know, it was rough in the 40s.
There's a lot of rough customers. Just a lot of people just getting shot.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, That's what I love about her performance so much. I mean, that's why I think she just steals the show. Because, I mean, you still, and I think you said this just a couple minutes ago, but you know, you still find yourself, as the audience member, you still find yourself, like, wanting to sympathize with her at times. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, yeah, you know, she is just getting the screws put to her, and she is under a lot of stress right now. And she's, you know, sure she killed a guy, but she was just freaked out.
She was trying to help out Jeff, that's all.
Yeah, she was trying to help. She thought things were gonna, she thought everything was upside down, or, you know, or whatever. Like, yeah, poor cat.
Yeah, what's funny is in that circumstance, you think about it, it's like, oh, well, she's just trying to help out Jeff. That's the man she loved. They're gonna be together. This is the thing. Then she leaves and goes back to Wit, and you're like, whoa.
And she steals his damn car.
Yeah, and you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
She apparently didn't give a shit and just killed him, and you're like, holy hell, like, she's dangerous as fuck.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, she really is. And, yeah, and speaking of scary people, Kirk Douglas in this movie is also very scary.
Yes.
That guy's got a lot of reach, and is very Wit has got a lot of reach, and he's very manipulative too, and he's very cunning. But for as cunning as he is, and like as scary as he is, he's still no match for Kathy.
Well, I love the way that he plays it too, because he's dumb to that fact.
Yeah.
You know, he just has this real, like, slick, you know, well, he's Kirk Douglas, so he looks how he looks, but he looks real polished, I guess, and has this I know more than anyone kind of air about him.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he is being completely subverted by Jane Greer or by Kathy, it's you know, her character is so many more steps in front of him. It's really kind of funny.
He's cuckolded by her.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
He's totally cuckolded by her. And, you know, because he knows she shot him. He's like, I need you back, baby. And then, then she shot him, and then she went out, and she had this affair, and she, you know, with Jeff. He's like, yep, I'll still take you back. And she's out carousing around. She's like, yeah, I'll still take you back. Like, he doesn't care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's completely cuckolded by her. And that's fascinating. It's really fascinating, because his character is otherwise so macho. And like I said, scary because he's scary because of the power and reach that he has. But he's also scary because, you know, you described that he's got the Kirk Douglas look, but that look is so intense and severe all the time. And he just constantly talks like he's just gritting it through his teeth.
It,
you know,
it absolutely makes me think of. You know, it seems to always boil back down to this, but he seems like a comic book character, like a Joker type.
Yeah, it's like his skull is just constantly trying to escape from his face. I mean, that's how intense he is all
the time. Yeah, he's incredibly, unbelievably, like, straining. It looks like he's always straining.
Yeah, no, I agree. And in a role like this, I mean, it adds to the character's credibility. You know, and it also adds to the complexity because of the fact, because like I said, he's a cuckold,
mm-hmm.
You know? And it's just bizarre. I think that that's the reason, I think that that's one of the reasons that the movie appeals to me, not because of like, I'm like, oh yeah, cuckold, that's my favorite kind of
weird thing. I get, but I like, really I like mean, that shit.
But like, you know, like that, like it's so complex, like the layers that this film has that like, others in the genre strive for but don't quite achieve.
Mm.
You know, there's so much going on, and like, you know, I mean, we could have just one conversation. We could have an hour-long conversation just about all of the shit Kathy does.
Sure.
You know, and still not even penetrate, like, you know, most of what's going on with the film. And I don't know. That's what I love so much about it.
Yeah, the things that I appreciate is, you know, I don't know, I like that opening so much, and especially when these two meet, when Jeff and Kathy meet, it's, and he sees her and he's narrating and he's talking about how he went to the bar every night, the first night, even though he knew she wouldn't be there, and it's this idea that he has her pegged.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the fact that everyone thinks they have their, you know, their thumb over Kathy. And everyone thinks they know that what she's going to do and how she's going to behave. And then as soon as they get her, their life's going to be what they want it to be. And she denies that. And, you know, it's like, I'm smarter than you. I'm going to do what I want to do. And that's how it's going to be. And I just think that that's a really nice mix in film, especially, you know, of this era. It's nice mm-hmm. to see something of that type. And I was just really appreciative of knowing that, you know, she has the upper hand throughout the film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, yeah, I think it's very different from something like, say, Mildred Pierce.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Where, and on a lot of different levels, but, you know, in the film version of Mildred Pierce, you know, Mildred is desperately holding on to what she thinks is cultural, social power, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like constantly striving to get it. But meanwhile, she's totally under everyone else's thumb and, you know, being, for lack of a better phrase, just being squashed by the man, as it were, by men. And, I mean, and I think you and I have talked about this briefly, but I mean, throughout that movie, I mean, she gradually becomes much more mannish as mm-hmm. the movie progresses. You know, she starts out wearing the gingham dress and she's at home, she's got long hair, and then her hair gets a little bit shorter and she's wearing pantsuits, and then she starts just drinking straight bourbon.
Yes.
You know, I mean, she starts to become man-like, or at least by, you know, film standards in 1940s gender standards, she becomes mannish. Whereas Jane Greer's character is the exact opposite. Everyone thinks that, you know, as you said, you know, that they have her under their thumb. They've finally tamed her, right? But they haven't. And she does nothing to be masculine. I mean, in fact, like, she accentuates her femininity and she's very sexual, and she uses all of those things to her advantage to gain control in the situation, while everyone else continually, if not deliberately, like, underestimates her. And, you know, and even though she dies at the end, ultimately she kind of wins. I mean, she gets everything she wants except for living, you know, and I suspect really the only reason she dies is just to make the Hays Code happy.
Sure. Well, yeah, it's one of those where it's like her lifestyle eventually would have to come up and, you know, get her eventually.
Hypothetically.
Maybe not necessarily for this story, but I can see why it's in the film.
Yeah, well, because it has to be. I mean, yeah. That's literally the Hays Code. I mean, she has to get her comeuppance.
Right.
So.
What do you think about, old Jeff meeting his end?
You know, it was fitting. He can't live.
Mm-hmm.
He can't live. He's constantly haunted by his past, and, he'll never escape it, no matter what. And furthermore, to make matters worse, to make matters worse, you know, as part of the narrative, he's an outsider, and everyone knows that he's an outsider. I mean, at the beginning of the movie, he's the mysterious Jeff Bailey. You know, I mean, yeah. either he has to be unpacked as a completely innocent dupe, you know, who's going to be able to go on with his life. I mean, that's option A. Or option B is that he's a dupe, sure, but he's not that innocent. And, you know, even though he doesn't really commit any crimes, he's certainly getting mixed up with the wrong kind of people. And he doesn't have any, and he certainly didn't have any qualms about giving, you know, Wit the information that would allow him to, you know, shirk the IRS, right? So, you know, he's kind of he's not really a dirty guy by film noir standards, but his hands aren't clean.
Well, and he doesn't have much of a sense of will either.
Yeah, no, he doesn't really have like a will to. There's not a will to live.
Mm-hmm. Because he seems happy enough with Anne, but like I was saying, how I appreciated that there wasn't a lurid scene when they first introduced them. There also wasn't a lot of passion. It didn't seem like.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Then let me ask you this: do you buy their relationship?
No, I don't. No.
Okay, then. The opposite of that, and I'm sure you can see this coming, do you buy the relationship between him and Kathy?
Of course.
Yeah. Well, there's the rub, right? Yeah. I mean, he's not.
But do you think that he? Level, but... Do you think that he realizes it? That it's not there with Anne, and it is, and it's not there like it was with Kathy. I could see him trying to go through the motions.
Here's. Oh man, I'm gonna hate myself for saying this, because I don't buy any of this Freudian psychobabble bullshit. Okay, like that's
or
not-
Or do you, Zach?
Psychology are very serious, sincere things that people should pay attention to, and there's a lot to learn from them. However, I don't buy it with Freud. Now, that being said, I think in this case, the death drive is a reasonable explanation, a reasonable literary or philosophic explanation. While that he outwardly, his ego wants him to be with Anne and do the right thing, or his superego, I guess, wants him to be with Anne and do the right thing and settle down. He has that death drive that Freud thinks everybody has, where he is constantly seeking the womb and a drive to go back. I mean, I think ultimately Jeff got what he wanted in the end. Mm. He wanted escape. He wanted release. And the only way that was going to come was through death. Why else drive this crazy murderer? I mean, actually drive her into a police barricade. What did he think she was going to do?
Right.
You know, I mean, it's not that, you know, I mean, Jeff, the character, the narrative are not limited to my imagination, but it's very hard for me to imagine that he didn't see that coming. He's not an idiot. You know, I think he wanted to die.
Hmm.
I think it's the death drive. Even if the character subconsciously wants to die, I mean, there's a desire to end it and escape, because that's the only way he can escape his past.
Right, because I think he understands that he tried to escape it by being this gas station owner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he tried to escape Kathy by being with Anne, this good girl.
Yeah,
but. He couldn't do it. You know, it's that guy coming, you know, and finding him and not being able to escape with. It's a thing where he realizes that he's never going to be free.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and how could he be?
Yeah.
Right. All the things that would have freed him are gone once Wit is murdered. And even if those things still existed, there's still those other thugs that he went and beat up and stole all those papers from.
Right.
That, I mean, aren't really happy with him. I mean, conceivably, they might not have the resources that Wit has, but conceivably, I mean, if he just happens to be in San Francisco and bumps into him, you know, they're, uh-oh, now what? You know, it's all over again.
Mm-hmm.
So. I mean, I think he knew exactly what he was doing. And I think that's why the dumb kid, the deaf and dumb kid, what was that kid's name?
The kid.
No, he had a name.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he has a name. Maybe it is the kid.
It's Dickie Moore, it plays the kid.
Yeah, it is. Okay, yeah, you're right, it is the kid. I thought they called, for some reason I was thinking they called him
I thought they called him something too, but I don't know, maybe not.
Maybe Jimmy? I don't know. Anyway, the kid. The deaf and dumb kid. I mean, perhaps that kid knew to lie to Anne, but probably not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, everything else was planned out up until that point. I mean, I have to believe that that Jeff saw this as an option and sort of fed him that line. If she asks, you know, tell her. I mean, there's no reason in the film to believe that, but I mean, everything that we know about the character, I feel makes that a pretty safe assumption.
Sure. I like that the kind of final moment of the film is him with a little nod and the wave. Cause it seems as though he understood Jeff.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like the person that you think, I mean, that he's called a deaf and dumb, you know, but the people that, you know, you underestimate know a lot more than you realize oftentimes.
Right.
And he's a perceptive thing. And so it's kind of like, you know, a goodbye in that maybe this is best sort of a way is the way that I took it. Like, well, you know, it's probably better and so long kind of a goodbye there. And I really liked that. I really liked it. You know, it's just a nice little ending for the film. It's not like a, and then they're dead. Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, cut, yeah.
You know, so I just thought it was a nice little kind of a bow to, you know, a wrapping things up way to end the film. So I really appreciated that.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly does restore, certainly not Jeff's life, but it does restore the status quo.
Sure.
For the outside world, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Anne runs off with the other guy who, you know, was,
the sandwich eater from the beginning.
Yeah, the sandwich eater, the guy who was the cop or whatever. I mean, who she was, quote unquote, you know, probably supposed to be with, right?
Yeah.
The
guy that was up, you know, he was the guy wondering where she was at the beginning. He was the one who was chasing after her, like how right. Jeff eventually chases after, you know, Kathy. And you don't see Jeff chasing after Anne. It's just kind of like, hey, Anne, come over here, by the way. You know, it's like whenever he needs her, she's there. He's never having to pursue her, but this sandwich eater, so I don't know what else his name is, but he's pursuing Anne, like that's his Kathy in a way, you know, or that's his end game is to be with her.
Right. But of course, he's the good guy who does the right thing, you know, always does the right thing all the time, you know, never fucks up, that sort of thing. Order is restored for what the world is allegedly supposed to be or is allegedly like. Jim, that's Jim. Anyway.
Jim, Richard Webb, yes.
Yes, that's who I was thinking they referred to as Jim. Anyway, it is what it is. I mean, I think that's just the way it's supposed to be.
Sure.
And the other thing is, that's so much better than if Jeff lived. Jeff has to die to make the movie.
Oh, yeah. Like, can you imagine if Jeff lives and he's in some forced happy ending with Anne?
Yeah.
And the Jim character arc never comes full circle or that story never completes. And you're like, okay. So he's like just settling with her and she's not what he wants. And, you know, she's always going to be disappointed in ways with him, and that's depressing, you know? I mean, yeah. I'm usually one for downbeat endings just because I get tired of the cliche happy endings, but that's not what I would have wanted here at all.
No. Yeah, I mean, and for me, I mean, honestly, I think the happy ending is with Jeff dead.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the happier ending, I mean, because then all of the loose ends are tied up. You know, I mean, everything's taken care of.
Yeah, well,
that's that.
Three of all the bad people are dead.
Yeah.
You know, Jeff, Kathy, Witt.
Yeah, and speaking of
Eels.
That's another interesting parallel, I think, too, between this and Double Indemnity is that line that Kathy has when they're standing out on the balcony looking at the mountains and stuff, which is another thing I want to get to. I think it's really interesting and unusual for noir, but, where she says, you know, you're no good and neither am I.
Mm.
It's why we deserve each other. I mean, that's almost exactly the line from Double Indemnity. You're rotten and, you know, we're both rotten, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's, that's sort of the nature of this, is the sort of the rottenness of these people. Even if they're not really rotten, I mean, you know, that there's that sort of belief, right?
Yeah, they're not kidding themselves.
Yeah, they're not kidding themselves. And, you know, and I don't know this for certain, but I mean, it almost seems like one of those sort of Hays Code impositions, you know? Mm. I mean, even if that's part of the original novel, or if that's something the writer really wanted in there, which in this case was the same guy that wrote the, you know, the screenplay, right? It was the same guy that wrote the novel.
Yeah, yep.
You know, even if that's something that he wanted in there as part of it, I mean, that's still playing right into the hand of the Hays Code, right? I mean, just saying like, yes, we're bad people, therefore our punishment is just, right? I mean, they can never get away with it, you know? Bonnie and Clyde always have to get shot up at the end.
Sure, yeah.
So, you know, I think that there's something culturally intriguing about that too. So.
Hmm. Well, tell me about the mountain. What is
the mountains? Okay. So when we were talking about movies and getting together and recording a couple of podcasts together, one that I suggested to you and that we talked about obviously before was Delmer Davies, Red House, right? Right. And one of the things we talked about there was the sort of the cinematic nature of how Davies handles it, because he, you know, he'd done a lot of Westerns and that sort of thing. So there's all those just beautiful landscape shots, right?
Sure.
Same thing in this movie. Just beautiful landscape shots of like Lake Tahoe.
Yeah. Not a film noir, trope.
No, not at all, right? It's another thing where they've sort of taken the noir thing and sort of turned it on its head, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because, you know, you know this, but let's pretend the listeners don't know this. You know, in film noir, the broad shots, like the big opening shots like that, they're cityscapes.
Yeah.
Right? It's the urban jungle that we're dealing with, not, you know, nature, not the outdoors. I mean, that's for Westerns, that's for romance stories or musicals or whatever, but like, Turnier and his, you know, director of cinematography, whoever it was, you know, they chose these shots that are really just cinematic and like really big, open, outdoor things. But at the same time, which is totally unusual for noir, which again, I think makes it that much more fascinating. But then they juxtapose those with these scenes with these really dark and heavy contrasts, and like, shadow and light are like coming into play like so significantly in like the formulation of each shot, especially as the film goes on and like things get darker and darker for Jeff,
mm-hmm.
you know, as his end nears. And, like the blending of those two, I think, very different styles and cinema, you know, very different choices in how to do the cinematography. I mean, the way that those just sort of seamlessly work together is really wonderful, I think, and really brilliant. And a thing that sets it apart from, you know, a lot of other film noirs. Cause even in Cat People, I mean, granted, Cat People takes place in a sort of a city, you know, backdrop. But I mean, even in Cat People, you know, there's a lot with the heavy, you know, the heavy contrasts and the shadows and the chiaroscuro sheet, you know, shading and all that kind of stuff. Like, but like, it's just, it's not as pronounced there because it's kind of expected there.
Hmm.
And where in this movie, I think someone else is free to disagree with me, but I think that those heavy shadows are more prominent because there's so many daylight scenes and so many mountain scenes and landscape scenes of Lake Tahoe and Mexico and all those places.
Sure.
It's really fascinating. Well, really fascinating.
What I think is a like an easy read of it is it's very much the character of Jeff.
Yeah.
You know, we meet him and it's all spread out and bright.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the flashback at the beginning, it's, you know, it's well lit and it's open. And then as it goes in, the walls and the light literally starts closing in on him, and it gets darker and it gets more claustrophobic feeling, you know. And I literally had paused it at one point, and I'm glad that you mentioned the, how it's different from a traditional noir. Cause I had paused it and checked my contrast, cause I had paused it at one point and got up and had like, you know, flopped on the remote or whatever and had checked it, because I was like, well, damn, this looks way darker than what I mm-hmm. thought it should have.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I didn't know, you know, going through the film, just watching it, I hadn't noticed it, because it's a more of a sort of a gradual thing. But when I had left to get up or for whatever and then come back, I was like, well, geez, this looks really dark.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wonder, like, it didn't feel that dark, you know, but then when you look at it, you're like, wow, it really is a shadowy second half of the film.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly like you said. I think you nailed it. I mean, those are the two worlds that Jeff is trying to live in, right? He's this sort of liminal figure who's trying to balance them both out, but he can't. He has to choose one or the other. You know?
Blonde hair, dark hair.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah. That's why I brought it up. I mean, he has to choose either the light or the darkness, and ultimately he ends up, even though he might outwardly try to reject the darkness, I mean, ultimately, you know. Ultimately, he's consumed by it and has to be a part of it.
I like that.
Yeah, it's a really, really wonderful sort of visual layer.
Yeah, it really is. It's a hell of a film. I mean, it's one where you hear, you know, you look at the IMDb page and it's got the golden classics and it's got the old poster and you're like, okay, well, I'm sure it's good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're like, I'm sure it's a quality film. I don't, you know, it's one of those things where I think I can be a little intimidated by films that are considered classics,
mm-hmm.
because I feel like it's my responsibility now to appreciate it. You know what I mean?
Like you owe something to like to history. Or
yeah. Like, our mutual friend Ben and Teed and I are going to be doing another Stanley Kubrick film soon.
Mm-hmm.
And,
which one are you doing?
We're doing A Clockwork Orange.
Oh, okay. That's a tough one.
Yes. and so that's why I bring this up. And so we are, I feel like for films that are considered classic, there is a sense of responsibility to understand the film, to appreciate the film, you know, to, dive into it and, you know, explore the film. It's not as simple as, oh, it's just a good movie, you know,
right.
To where in a modern film, like I could go see, you know, whatever, Interstellar or whatever, or Gone Girl or something, and be like, oh, that was really good. I liked this part of it and this part of it. But it doesn't have that weight of it being this classic that's almost 70 years old in this case.
Right.
You know, and so I was a little bit on the intimidated side for this one. Not so much for The Red House, because that was a film that I hadn't heard of and it was a little harder to get. So I was like, well, this is harder to find, I don't know if it's going to be a classic per se. So mm-hmm. I wasn't as intimidated by that, but this one I was like, okay, well, I know this is a classic noir, and I just kind of had like these expectations, and I was glad that I did, because I had those expectations kind of turned upside down by Kathy's character, and like you mentioned about Jeff being the, you know, being the damsel in distress, essentially.
Yeah.
So I was kind of glad for a change that I had those preconceptions going into it.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes that helps to, because you're even if you don't want to be, I mean, you're ultimately startled by it, right? I mean, I felt that same way about Mildred Pierce.
Oh yeah.
The first time I saw that, I was startled because I hadn't read the book. I frankly didn't know anything about it going into it, other
you
than it had
that dirty daughter sex stuff.
I did, actually, and because that was, you know, I was just genuinely surprised that how much they got away with in that and how much they put into that. And, but, you know, I didn't quite know what to expect from Mildred or her character arc. I mean, because and through a lot of the film, like, I found myself saying, like, okay, so what makes this noir again? This just seems like it's sort of like a, you know, I couldn't quite pin like what the genre was, but I was like, it sort of seems like a coming of age story. What is this? What is going on here? Is it like a soap opera type story? What is this? And, because of what my expectations for noir were. So, you know, it was so jarring to me that it's one of those, another one of those films that just sort of has stuck with me always.
Yeah.
Or at least ever since I've seen it. I feel like Out of the Past is the same way.
Sure.
And again, for another Tournier film, you know, Cat People. I feel the same way about Cat People. You go into it, you're like, Cat People? What is this? Some schlocky B-movie horror bullshit? And it, and in certain ways, I mean, it kind of is, but like, but really, you sit down and you watch it and you go, oh my God. Like, what? And your expectations are just completely shattered. Hmm. And you have to sort of rethink like how you approach movies like it. You know, it's just one of those. I mean, Tournier is one of those sort of auteur, directors of the era, like Billy Wilder or like Hitchcock or somebody else. He's just not as well known,
right?
You know, So.
Yeah, it's a hell of a movie. If people haven't checked it out, obviously we would definitely recommend you do so. Was there anything else that you wanted to mention, Mr. Carusi?
Let me check my notes real quick. You know, the only other thing that I just kind of wanted to say about it was that this is a movie where, you know, Robert Mitchum's character and Robert Mitchum as an actor sort of, like we discussed, set an expectation about what you expect from Robert Mitchum and who he is. And Robert Mitchum is very much Robert Mitchum, but he's not I think this is true. Was likely true of him in real life too. I don't think Robert Mitchum is the macho tough guy that people often assume that he is because of many of the roles that he's played. And I think that this, even though he's completely overshadowed by Jane Greer in this movie, I think this is the role where Mitchum is his most, honest,
like true to himself.
I think this is the role that seems to me that's the truest to Robert Mitchum.
It's not Night of the Hunter for you,
right? Yeah, it's not Night of the Hunter. It's not even Mitchum in, you know, it's not Mitchum in any of the westerns that he did, like the stuff he did with John Wayne. It's not Mitchum in his 1970s remake of
Big Sleep as Marlowe.
Of the Big Sleep, sure. Right? Yeah, as Philip Marlowe. I mean, it's not any of that. I mean, and that's not to say he's bad in any of those. I think he's terrific in any of those. But I think that movies like those give Mitchum this sort of macho varnish or mystique or however you want to frame it.
Especially in like the Cape Fear.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Cape Fear. Sure. Cape Fear is another classic example where they, I think, just give Mitchum this like macho mystique that I don't think he actually is. Or has, or I guess was would be the operative, would be the correct verb tense here. But I don't think that's Mitchum. I think the character that he plays here, I think Jeff Bailey is the closest to the type of person that Robert Mitchum is. I think there's a real naturalness about how he plays the role. And very, you know, and I don't want to read too much into it, I suppose, but I really feel like this is the one. This is the one time where I feel like it's really 100% just natural. Just go with it.
Just feels true to you.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't know if that makes any sense or not, but that's how I feel about it because I've seen plenty of Robert Mitchum movies. But this is the one that feels the most honest to me.
I like that. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I've seen maybe a handful of his films, so I don't know enough either way, but I like the idea of that, Carusi, so we'll just go ahead and go along with it.
Do it. Let's
all right.
Take that.
Well, so let's wrap it up here. If you happen to have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for Podshots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You could follow the show under the handle @plainlabelpod over at Twitter. You could follow me over there. I'm @ericwilliams79. We also have a Facebook page for the show. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. If you wanted to help us out, you could go over to our website, which is plainlabelpodcast.tumblr.com. And over there, we're going to have an Amazon ad over on the right-hand side. And what I want you to do is click on that ad. That'll take you to Amazon's homepage. I want you to bookmark that homepage. And then anytime you use Amazon for anything, it helps us out in the process. It doesn't change anything for you. It just helps pay for our, you know, renting of movies, our Netflix, our movie tickets. Everything movie related is what it helps us out in paying for. So that would be really, that'd be nice. That'd be good. I want to, I do want to thank Zach once again for coming on. I think number two you are for most visits to this here show.
Who's number one?
My friend Steve, Mr. Steve Bruns, a fellow teacher of ours.
He's dead.
Steve and I are recording tomorrow as of recording.
He's dead. It's over for him. It's over.
He doesn't know. I don't know. He's a Chicago way kind of guy. So,
well then,
better watch out. But yeah,
his disappearance will be less suspicious.
It'll be a little big city. It's a little more believable.
Yeah.
But if people wanted to hear more from Mr. Krusey here, they could check us out on our previous discussions of Valhalla Rising, Scotland, PA. We did a documentary double feature of the Wild and Wonderful Whites of West Virginia and the Queen of Versailles. We talked about the film that we've discussed a few times on this episode, Double Indemnity, and we just most recently did The Red House. But if people wanted to get a hold of you outside of that, where could they do so?
They should follow me on the Twitter, which is at Zach Krusey, and that's ZackKruse, in case you don't know how to spell. I was going to end that with my name, but let's just leave it as, in case you don't know how to spell. anyway, you can follow me there, or you can go over to ZackKruse.com, which is my sort of Tumblr page, which is rarely updated, but has links to all the other great and wonderful things that I do, among which is the Appleseed Comics and Art Convention here in lovely Fort Wayne, Indiana, and you can find more out about that at AppleseedCon.com.
And Zach does lots of the things.
I do lots of the things. So many of the things. Like, I can't even handle it.
Can't even handle it. That's true. Well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.
Hello, Marnie.
Well, look who's back.
You dye your hair.
Why?
I always keep thinking of you as a blonde.
For all the thinking you do about me, I could be bald-headed.
Come on, Ryan. Did you miss me, honey?
If I didn't, I can't think of anybody else who did. One thing's sure, that Bailey don't miss nothing.
Neither do you.
She's your girl, and he ain't my man, so it's no skin off my nose. Wishing you well. Find at peace within yourself. Covers up against you. Still you